ship the books, the mailing cost, and to buy dictionaries. So every book, whether you think you a prisoner would want it or not, it doesn't matter. Drop your books off at the IMC at the post office in downtown Urbana, and they will be put to good use.
And if you want to call your bookshelf of all those dictionaries that you don't use anymore because you use online dictionary, bring those down there. As you mentioned, they're specially welcome. I think even foreign language dictionaries too.
They are. Inmates are so, you know, it's with the tragedy of the what's going on in the system right now with all the isolation and the literally people primarily, if you are in prison, you're primarily in solitary confinement. You're generally not let out of your cell 23 hours a day in certain prisons here in Illinois, even though you're not technically in solitary confinement for a reason. That's just the way the prisons are ran these days. I'm going to be reporting next week on CU Progressive News on a story I'm following of this woman who was, her name is Tiffany, and she died in Sangamon County Jail, or as a result of her injuries in the jail, self-injury in the jail. She hung on for a while, but she was tried to commit suicide at the age of 12 and was really an abused person and was traumatized and then got into the criminal justice system through just doing some sex work. And then just the crazy thing was, Paul, she was hired by somebody to be a dancer or something. And the person that hired her was an adult, but the person who she danced for was a minor. Mm. And so she got this conviction this conviction with sex with a minor kind of thing, and got her 5 years in prison for it.
This is all in Sangamon County?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jeez. Yep, yep. And she passed away this week from injuries. But one of the things that was so atrocious about her case was because she was on suicide watch, she literally spent 8 months on suicide watch where they paid somebody to watch her. Three shifts, one person staring at her in through glass. This is how they do suicide watch there. And so she had nothing but a blanket in her cell for 8 months, alone in a cell, having someone stare at her.
That's like solitary confinement while being watched. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's torture. It's torture. That's what it is. We're torturing prisoners every day in Illinois. It's a fact, and I'm going to be covering it more and more. I've been following the Uptown People's Law Center, Alan Mills out of Chicago. He is doing such great work. He's bringing class action lawsuits for prisoners, and she was one of the people in his class action lawsuit. So he goes and gets to interview prisoners all the time. He's in all the prisons, and he's just such a great activist and a lawyer, and runs the Uptown People's Law Center. So be having some stories from him
coming
up.
We should do a shout out to Brian Dolinar for driving over to Springfield and giving testimony at the, as he put it, the criminal committee.
It's what it's literally called.
Yeah. I don't know about that. Maybe they're assigning that adjective to themselves, I suppose.
That was trying to get, he was trying to get the phone, so that they didn't just have a video visit. So we're really trying to prevent that, because it's a racket. It is one more way that they just isolate the prisoners more by only allowing video visits instead of face-to-face visits. And then they also charge for them. It's another charge. It's another, you know, it's great to have it as an option for the people who can't get to Vienna or somewhere, and their folks, you know, live in Chicago and they're confined in Vienna, but there's no reason to make it replace face-to-face visits. That's crazy.
There aren't any criminal justice-related referendums on the ballot this coming Tuesday, but there are the business about the nursing home, which I hope you're informed about. I don't think it's a hard call. It's not a lot of money, and we certainly shouldn't sell it. It should remain. The other thing, I don't know, I guess there was a phone, a recorded call program with Aaron just now. I don't know whether he included in that the business about the meeting on Monday. I believe it's the Carpenters Hall on Windsor Road, Windsor and Duncan. No, that's not right. They don't intersect. Duncan and Springfield, that's where the Carpenters Hall is. And the great Ralph Martire, an analyst of the budget, is going to be there along with Carol Ammons, and they're going to talk about higher education funding. I'm sure there'll be some discussion of more general misrepresentations of the budget.
He's going to be at five o'clock. They're going to be at Lincoln Hall. At 7 o'clock, they're going on Monday. They're going to be at Mount Olive Missionary Church. And there's another one.
Oh no, you're right. That was an earlier conference that Carol Ammons sponsored.
Okay, so that's where. What do you know about him?
He's brilliant. He's incisive about the budget, Center for Budget Priorities, and he's out of Bloomington, I believe.
Okay.
He is pretty much bollocksed out of the mainstream media, so it'd be great if we had some coverage of him. At the time of the increase of the income tax, the surcharge that went away, and now we have a lower effective income tax than most people in Indiana pay for personal income tax. He was not able to put op-eds in any of the major papers at the time of that surtax increase. And what he was trying to say was this idea that Illinois is a high-tax state is rubbish, but the corporate media doesn't want you to know that.
Hmm.
We have a non-progressive income tax, and it is quite low by standards. We have a high property tax, and that ought to be fixed. It's true. But the income tax is not a high, and we're not a high tax state in that regard at all. And he brings a lot of analysis to the issue that you don't hear on, you know, with just the stereotypes and the commonplaces that Illinois is a high tax state.
Okay.
Anyway, speaking of money, has anybody called lately?
No. You're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org, and we are waiting for your call at 359-9338. Now that we have two people in the house, we can take your call easily. And I did want to spend, if Paul can talk to us just a minute about the Champaign County Nursing Home, and I know he's got other stuff lined up, but we will say that that's on the April 4th budget. And the thing that I was shocked about to learn last week when we talked to Carol about it, Carol Ammons, was that when she was on the county board, she voted against the current management they have of the Champaign County Nursing Home because the Champaign County Nursing Home has hired a management company instead of having a manager from within. They have a management company running it. That management company is out of St. Louis, and it is not perhaps well managed, and that is one of the problems that people are, you know, pointing to as a reason we should sell it. But actually, why not get just a good management company that A, doesn't have a conflict of interest? The same management company is a company that buys up nursing homes and privatizes them. So ironically, they could have mismanaged it to a point where it's for sale for not much money because it's been sort of victimized by bad management, and then be eligible to purchase it. So that is that was startling news to me. That
at a very high contract value too. They're being paid a really huge amount.
Buying into the whole thing of that Rauner's agenda, which is to dismantle the public good and sell it into privatization, which is what his investment companies did. And one of the largest nursing home settlements ever was made in Florida for Rauner's company who does the investments. And it was several million dollars paid to one person because it wasn't just an act of neglect, but an act of specific cruelty in their neglect, that they literally knew this woman would die from this neglect and did it anyway. And that's why the settlement was so big. Anyway, so lots to think about with the nursing home, but definitely we want to keep it into the public realm. And that would be a no vote for selling it and a yes vote for supporting it with our tax dollars, which should be less than $30, $35 for people who own a home of $100,000-$150,000 value. I'm going to turn it over.
More than mine. Sandra will be graciously out in the great hall, as we call it, to take your phone calls. The number down here is 359-9338. It's a little informal today because of the, it's already 10 minutes in. My gosh. So often I'll play material that I don't get to the next day. We don't have anything from Black Agenda Report this week. Again, I don't know what's up with the guys. Hopefully soon they'll have some more incisive commentary. Amy Goodman's up, and something we haven't mentioned today is the internet vote this week on not only your privacy is eroded, but people can, quote-unquote, in the expression, monetize it, sell your info. So I don't know if you're doing more private browsing than you had in the past, but that is an option. They don't maybe might make your Google searches a little more less tailored to you, but sometimes that's a good thing too. Amy Goodman on that subject right here, breaking the sound barrier. That's a regular feature here. We've got some stuff with Intercepted from Jeremy Scahill. His colleague Naomi Klein is quite eloquent today, and we'll see what we can get to. Probably won't get to the app that Apple keeps. I almost got it this week. It was available for 5 hours. This is a thing called Metadata Plus that I have been talking about a little bit, but some guy just made an app that chronicled, pinged him whenever a drone strike happened and gave him the geography and where it was and what its purported mission was, that kind of thing. And it's been a six-year struggle to get it available. It keeps getting taken down by Apple. And they did it again. It was available for 5 hours on maybe Tuesday this week. And I posted an article about its availability and then looked for it, and it was gone again. So there you go. As if this is some kind of national security issue, who we're killing and where we're killing them. And, okay, 359-9338, that's something we haven't done in a while, is give the phone number. Please do call. You can go online, but it's always nice to hear about support. And here's Amy Goodman.
Your privacy is for sale. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Unless you're reading this column in a good old newspaper, odds are your internet service provider, or ISP, knows what you're up to. ISPs are the on-ramp to the internet. It's through these gatekeepers that we all access the web. They set the price and the speed of your connection, but we're legally prevented from sharing or selling details about your personal internet usage without your permission, until now. Through a resolution that narrowly passed both the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate on partisan lines, internet privacy protections implemented by the Obama administration will be entirely eliminated. Companies like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon now can sift through your personal information, your web browsing history, where and when you access the internet, and what you do while online, and peddle that private data to whomever is willing to pay. President Donald Trump, while obsessed with the imagined invasion of his own privacy, as indicated by his tweeted charge that President Obama wiretapped him during his campaign, is expected to sign this bill into law, stripping privacy away from hundreds of millions of Americans.
Americans pay for that service. They don't expect that information to be shared or used for other purposes or sold without their permission.
That's Laura Moy on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Moy is the deputy director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at the Georgetown University Law Center.
Americans absolutely need internet connectivity in today's modern era. You need to go online to search for a job. You need to go online to complete your education. You need to go online often to communicate with your healthcare provider or conduct your banking.
All of this communication, all of this internet use can be conducted from the privacy of your home. But don't think it's going to remain private. Your ISP can vacuum up your searches, your interests, what movies you watch online, your age, weight, social security number, medical conditions, financial troubles. If you start searching online for a bankruptcy lawyer or for treatment for addiction, your ISP will add that to your profile. Again, Laura Moy.
We want people to use the internet to view it as a safe space to communicate with others, to express their political viewpoints, to carry out these vitally important everyday activities, and to do so without fear that the information that they share with their internet service provider will be used to harm them in some way.
Well, that was the hope. The internet privacy rules that are being eliminated fill 219 pages and were worked on at the Federal Communications Commission for over a year, supported by over 275,000 comments from citizens and advocacy groups. They were published in the Federal Register last December. The effort to eliminate them was championed by Tennessee Republican Congressmember Marsha Blackburn, who chairs the subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee that oversees the FCC. As reported in Vocative, Blackburn, during her 14 years in Congress, has received at least $693,000 in campaign contributions from companies and individuals from AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, and other industry members that stand to profit from the rules change. Blackburn's willing partner in the repeal of the rules is the FCC's new commissioner, Ajit Pai, who used to serve as associate general counsel for, you guessed it, Verizon. He was one of the two Republicans on the five-seat FCC during Obama's second term and was promoted to FCC chair by President Donald Trump. According to the Los Angeles Times, Pai gave a speech last December in which he promised to take a weed whacker to another hard-won progressive victory, net neutrality. Immediately after the House voted to repeal the privacy rules, Free Press, the National Media Policy Advocacy Group, stated the broadband privacy fight is the Trump administration's first attack on the open internet. And now that it has a win on its hands, it'll be pushing for another, they wrote. It's absolutely shocking that Donald Trump, in the midst of his accusations that his own privacy was invaded by illegal wiretaps, is signing into law permission to invade, sell, trade, and monetize the most private, intimate details of every internet-connected American. This law is the ultimate hack, allowing corporations to take all of our information and sell it for profit. In Donald Trump's America, the information isn't stolen by hackers in the dark of night. It's taken with the government's blessing. Unless people organize and fight back, the promises of the open internet will fade away. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well said. Amy's been doing some great work. She even had this Robert English on. I was going to play him this week from Flashpoints, but since she already did a segment with him, he's the Russian scholar that... is joining the chorus on the Russia hysteria, I think it almost is. I don't like to use that word, actually, frankly, but since it's gender-loaded. But fanaticism that we're seeing, you know, Trump was certainly mobbed up, and oligarchs of various flavors, Saudi Sultanates, whatever they're called, Russian oligarchs, dumped money into him. I mean, the Saudis bail out his casinos, which is kind of funny because nominally they're not supposed to be gambling, but then we know that they're the high rollers in some of the casinos. So it's madness. But not to say there isn't a lot of stuff to plumb in the depths of his financial structure. They tried to release all of this financial information on his appointees on a Friday, maybe trying to not draw attention to it. The fact that we still don't know if he's really got any money or at all, or whether he's just got a carapace of huge amount of debt and the value of his name, quote unquote. But since Amy had that, I foresaw it. I've been playing that as a drumbeat. People like Robert Perry and Ray McGovern, ex-CIA, Russian specialist, Soviet Union specialist in his day, CIA briefer. And I'm not confident that we'll get anything out of these hearings. But the what is his last name at this point? I can't remember. The guy from Fresno who snuck onto the White House grounds to get information that he then briefed the White House about. That's so Kafkaesque. Nunes, yeah, yeah, a dairy farmer. Somebody was trying to say that he was selling wine to Russian oligarchs or something, and that he had a vested interest. But apparently, unless they're buying his boutique cheese at very high prices, I mean, the scale of madness about this is large, and I recommend Consortium News. Marjorie Cohn on BDS today, something I haven't hit in a while. I'm having Danny Otto on tomorrow. He recently was in the West Bank for a conference on the Balfour 100th anniversary. So he's going to talk about that. He's from sort of the Mennonite Peace Church flavor of religious activism, if you will. I hope he doesn't mind that characterization. But... So nothing on that really today, but Greg Palast has an interesting take on the collapse of the Trump care, if you will, that I hadn't heard anywhere else. He believes the election was stolen again because of voter suppression. I've been arguing this week, someone, and one of the things I came back with when I was attacked for supporting Greens in Illinois, which is a safe HRC state, was that lost in the details again, but I'm sorry, that trailed off. I better go to some material from Greg Palast and Dennis Bernstein. I've been playing this election theft report all the way up to the election for about a cold quarter of a year. And how it was so close that it could be stolen. That's the point I was, I guess, yammering about there. The three states that are most pivotal. But voter suppression is still happening. And they and various states have even more power to do that kind of thing. And we're seeing it happen. So this is the election protection report. We haven't had it on in a while because it's after the crime. But we'll get to that right now. Again, the phone number down here is 359-9338.
So many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
30
seconds. Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
I don't even think it was controversial. You know, I proved them. I haven't even heard. I haven't had one call from anybody saying, oh, that was a terrible thing you did. Shut up!
And welcome back to Flashpoint's Post-Election Crimes Bulletin with our good friend Greg Palast, best-selling author, producer of the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And we have been keeping an eye on what's been going on since the election. And Greg's latest piece is Trump Care Dies, XL Flies, and the secret winner is... Who is it, Greg?
Four-letter word, K-O-C-H, Coke.
Coke.
Three of them.
Now, you mean lines? There are lines of Coke, and we're having them shoved down our noses.
Yes, and, this is the trick one, because it's three brothers Coke now. See, everyone
three Cokes.
Knows Charles and David.
Three
right?
lines, okay.
And there's also Brother Billy has cashed in big. Friday was a super day for the Coke brothers, so I hope you bought stock in Coke Industries. That's a trick statement, Dennis. You can't. It's the biggest private company. They keep it all. There's no stock. There's no SEC looking at their operations. So yes, on Friday two things happened. We all know that Trump Care, Ryan Care, did a face plant. It was found face down in the Washington Monument reflecting pool. So at 3 p.m., Trump announced death of his own bill, Trump Care. But at 10 a.m., he also announced the formal approval by his State Department of the Keystone XL pipeline extension, the Keystone XL pipeline. These two items together meant a $21 billion, that's with a bull, $21 billion windfall for the brothers Koch, the three of them.
Not bad.
And both of those bills put together. And it's interesting because what
they get seven apiece, right?
Not quite. Brother Billy's was shafted out of his share of the company's looting, so he'll only make about $1 billion off the deal. Don't cry for him, though.
He's not going to be able to afford his own health care. Jeez.
So what's happened is, I don't know why I'm laughing, it's pretty disastrous, but you almost have to laugh to see a blowhard like Trump actually bend to the will of these billionaires far more powerful than he is. And so just to give people some context, if you haven't seen the film yet, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, that's the last plug for that. It has the story of why the Kochs are so darn interested in the XL pipeline. There's two reasons. The first is in the film, which is that You know, it's taking Canadian oil across the United States, across our aquifers, down to Texas. Now, Texas has a little oil, as you may know, and so why in the heck would you take coal? It's like coal to Newcastle. It's oil to Texas. The answer is at the end of the pipeline is the Cokes refinery on the Gulf Coast, which cannot use Texas oil because it's just not filthy enough, or as they say in the biz, heavy enough with sulfur to be used in the Coke refinery. So they are stuck. There's only two places that the Koch brothers can get oil for their refinery, Canada, and there's no way to get that unless they get this pipeline, or Venezuela, you know, which meant that they were a captive customer of Hugo Chavez and now his successor, Nicolas Maduro, who, I hate to say it, never give the Kochs a discount, believe it or not. They really have stuck it to the Kochs. And this infuriates the Kochs. They couldn't get rid of Chavez and Maduro yet. So they need that pipeline. When that pipeline is finished and ends at their refinery, they will save, just two guys, personally, $1 billion a year. But that's not all. Remember I said that there's a third brother cashing in and celebrating. Billy Koch, he owns a business called Oxbow Carbon. You know, that stuff that fries the planet. His brothers also own a business called Carbon. It's a subsidiary called Koch Carbon. Koch Carbon and Oxbow Carbon take the carbon, that is, they take the tar from the tar sands oil, which is coming down from Canada towards their refinery. They take out the tar along the way, and they take this gunk out of the pipeline, because otherwise the oil literally wouldn't be able to move. They take it out, and they let it dry in stacks bigger than the pyramids in Detroit, Chicago, and elsewhere along the pipeline routes. They take this gunk, let it dry in the open, and now they can't. You can't burn. It's like hardened oil, hardened sludge. It is so toxic that it's against the law to burn it in the United States. So what do? They ship it to China, where China burns it. It still goes in the atmosphere. It still fries our planet, but the particulates are more likely to choke a Chinese than someone in the U.S. because it's completely illegal. So we literally permit the massive shipment of poison to other nations. And that's what they do with that Coke. So Billy will probably make about $1 billion, give or take, over the life of the pipe from the gunk he pulls out of it. His brothers will make about $20 billion between about 10 each. So it was a good day for the Kochs with the pipeline. And then, if that wasn't enough, they got their wish, because they're the ones, not Nancy Pelosi. Sorry, Nancy, you didn't do it. The Koch brothers killed Trump Care, Ryan Care.
Now, how'd they do that?
Freedom Partners. Freedom Partners is the Koch front that works with their other fronts like Americans for Prosperity, but it's like a pack. The Freedom Partners executive told members of the Freedom Caucus, and don't worry about distinguishing the two because they're fairly indistinguishable, the Koch's Freedom Partners and the Freedom Caucus. The Freedom Caucus is the brown shirt, uber right segment of the Republican Party with 30-some members. Freedom Partners told the Freedom Caucus anyone commits to opposing Ryan Care, Trump Care, whatever you want to call it, they will support that person's candidacy to the tune of seven figures, and if you add the zeros of seven, that's over $1 million that they'll put in to defend anyone to support someone running for re-election, because Trump had threatened to primary members of the Freedom Caucus if they dared vote against his bill or say they would. Now, in the old days, I kid you not, Dennis, this is a crime. You cannot tell someone, you vote a certain way and I'll give you $1 million. And it doesn't matter that it goes into their campaign fund as opposed to their, you know, to their bank accounts, personal bank accounts. It is bribery, straight and simple. It's a federal felony. And in fact, a strange precedent is that this elderly lady who was a member of the League of Women Voters told a state senator in Illinois, if you vote for the Equal Rights Amendment and run into trouble, The League of Women Voters will make sure that you get funded in your, you know, to defend your seat. She ended up in prison. But the Kochs, believe it or not, are not ending up in prison. They're celebrating.
So they played a key role in what you're saying is in sinking the attempt to get rid of Obamacare.
They purchased the vote. Yeah, they bought that vote. Now, you might say, oh, well, that Obamacare kind of survived, so now we won't have people dropping dead because of lack of meth clinics in New Hampshire. But that's temporary. But you'd say, well, why wouldn't they back this bill, the Kochs? Well, because it still costs them money, you know, because they have employees and they have to pay the extra insurance costs. But the question is, why did Ryan or Trump even have the bill? And this is the backstory, which is really, really interesting. According to the Congressional Budget Office, and get ready for this, more people would lose their health insurance under Ryan Care than if they simply repealed Obamacare. Dig that? In other words, literally, right. Ryan Care was worse than nothing, okay? So why would they throw millions more people out of, you know, out of our hospitals? You know, empty the beds, you're out, you're not covered. What is behind this? The answer is it was never a health insurance or health care bill. It's a tax cut parading as a health insurance bill. In particular, Obamacare had paid for some of those subsidies that put people, you know, that gave people care, with a 3.75% tax on what is called passive investment income, what we, you and I, Dennis, call speculation profits, right. You know, speculation windfalls. So it was a surcharge on speculators. Actually, one of the few really progressive things that Obama did do, he hit speculators. In fact, your income has to approach $1 million in order to get hit by this thing. So it was really a very progressive tax. Well, progressive tax is a terrifying thing to people like Paul Ryan, and in particular his benefactor. The guy who created and funded the career of Paul Ryan is a guy that we've talked about many times, the vulture, Paul Singer. Now, Paul Singer really despises Donald Trump. He's made that clear in public. But yet, here he was last week or a week and a half ago when Trump had his psychobabble, psychotic meltdown of a press conference. You know, he did mention that Paul Singer was in his office, the Oval Office. Now, why would Singer, who despises Trump, be in his office? Well, one, Trump is president, and he has a lot of goodies to give out, and I'm sure that Singer had a big wish list. But undoubtedly, because of the timing, the effect, it was, listen, I've got to get rid of that investment tax on my earnings and on my, you know, on my kills. And that means, and the vehicle will be a health care bill that Paul Ryan has. So he was fronting, you know, obviously Trump is not in love with Paul Ryan, but he was thrilled that Singer was coming back into his fold, into his flock. And so, you know, so Singer was very much behind Ryan Care because that was a gigantic tax hit that would be removed. He'd have a massive tax cut. In fact, the total cut, ready? That one tax was a $157 billion hit over the next 10 years, $157 billion hit on speculators like the vulture. But here's the thing. The Kochs don't use that tax benefit. They don't make their money from speculation. They make their money from despoiling Mother Nature. They have pipelines
product,
and,
right.
And well, they have oil and drilling and pipelines and tankers, and they also, you know, cut down trees. They own Georgia right. Pacific paper mills, and so, you know, so they actually have employees, and they don't, but they don't make their money from speculation. So they're not subject to this speculator tax, whereas the vulture is. So it's very interesting. In other words, you have a billionaire on billionaire rumble. And the Kochs beat the vulture, at least in this case. And that's what it was really about. It was a fight between billionaires.
All right.
And
well,
the Kochs won.
Well, Greg Palast, gregpalast.com, where are you looking next? What little excursion into the dirt of U.S. corporate and government actions are you pursuing at the moment?
Well, as you know, I just love hunting billionaires. That's what I do for a living. You know, for Rolling Stone.
That's why you're so
but
wealthy.
I've also, and I'm not going to tell you the details. I'm just going to tantalize you.
All right, go on. Do it in 30 seconds.
Okay, I'm going to team up with a guy named Alan Grayson, who really knows his stuff about finance, the former congressman from Florida. And we've got we're kicking off a very interesting investigation that's going to make some big heads and maybe super gigantic heads roll. So that's what I'm up to now.
Well, roll up for the mystery tour.
Dennis Bernstein and Greg Palast, I love those guys. They have a real rapport, it seems to me. And
they bring great information.
Indeed. This business about the Koch brothers not needing the massive tax cut that was really what the Ryan Care, Trump Care bill was about, that it didn't benefit them, so they bankrolled the Liberty group or whatever, the Freedom mm-hmm. faction of the Republicans to vote against it because it wasn't their it wasn't their tax cut. So that means what are they going to be lobbying for since the next item of business is tax cuts for the wealthy? So we get to thank my friend the arborist,
yes.
Or archerist.
Puts us over the 5,500 mark, too. Happy to say, on our way to 22,000, Ken Green made a donation. He's from Saybrook, uh-huh. and he says he loves to listen on Saturday mornings and enjoys all of our efforts down here, and he made a nice pledge to us, and we really, really appreciate that. So thank you, Ken, as you're out doing your gardening and your morning work and whatever. He says he puts it in his pocket and takes it with him.
Very good. It was 49 member donations a bit ago, and now it's 53. So I gather you gathered some
from the web
higher
as
ground.
Well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Well.
And a couple from Higher Ground. Yep. So we are at 53 donation. People have donated so far and looking to keep pushing that up. We know that... you know, News from Neptune's been on a long time, and you have a long, long history here, Paul. Lots of listeners who have been politicized by you and the conversations you've had. I certainly appreciate all the listening that you do through the week to bring us what you have brought, you know, to bring us the condensed version of what we need to know this week.
Yeah, well, it's... it would be like calling something All Things Considered or something and having the arrogance of calling... all you need to know this week, but at least I try. And it's really hard to sort things out now, what the priorities of what you want to put on these days, because there's just so many gaping wounds in our body politic, if to use a really disgusting metaphor, but I think it's warranted. So I try. I do what I can.
I mean, seriously, we're watching the whole, you know, democracy fall apart before our eyes. And yeah. I know it's been happening for a while and certainly been eroded. But the way it's escalating right now is worth having community radio here so that we can follow along in every method that we can from people who are intelligently looking at news sources. And that's really what you get with Paul. And it's a rare thing, Paul. I really do appreciate it. I want you to know that.
I actually listen to more straight ahead public radio through the week, trying to figure out how they're covering things. And I tweet a lot to them to try to get some of these alternative views on. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then I try to catch up with all of the alternative stuff that's going on. Like I said, there was Colleen Raleigh this week, this guy Robert English, all sorts of interesting stuff. But I think as far as the fate of the planet goes, you can't go to anybody better than Naomi Klein. And that's what I got up next. They spoke for about 35 minutes. I have a segment of that. I recommend you go to The Intercepted for the rest of it. This is this 10th podcast from Jeremy Scahill and crew. It's a project of The Intercept, which mm-hmm. is Glenn Greenwald's and Jeremy Scahill started it. Some tech millionaire, billionaire or something financed it. And he's to be thanked for it. But I think it was PayPal or something, one of the PayPal financers.
Okay, give us a call at 359-9338 or go online at weft.org and donate there. We really need you to donate to keep this kind of radio on the air.
Okay, Naomi Klein and Jeremy Scahill, our colleague from The Intercepted. I recommend you go to the whole thing. Actually, the only thing I have for April Fool's Day is this little intro at the beginning. So cue the Burt Bacharach soundtrack.
Quite sure that I think people in the West Wing had. If I really wanted to, I could have snuck onto the grounds late at night and probably nobody would have seen me. I'm quite sure that I think people in the West Wing had no idea that I was there.
He's gone off on a lark by himself, sort of an Inspector Clouseau investigation here.
Why did you meet with a source on the White House grounds the evening before you came out in that news conference?
I know when there is a trouble and when there is not a trouble. And I can definitely tell you that there is a trouble. You may rest assured of that.
Did you think it might be conspicuous for the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee to be visiting the White House complex at night?
Please tell me nothing. I prefer to investigate the scene of the crime spontaneously. That way it gives my trained instincts full rein, you know?
By holding the meeting on the White House grounds, it makes it appear that someone in the administration was coordinating the release of this information to you. Is that not the case?
It is my business to look at trouble. Monsieur, all I require is a phone, my little bag of tools, and some privacy in which to work. That is all I require.
Why would you need to brief the White House on what you yourself have called executive branch documents?
Very ingenious. In this case, it is a clue.
Do you understand why it might have been better to avoid that kind of meeting at the White House?
That is why I have always failed where others have succeeded. For me, the greater the odds, the greater the challenge. And as always, I accept this challenge.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 10 of Intercepted.
Perhaps no single regulation threatens our miners, energy workers, and companies more than this crushing attack on American industry. My action today is the latest in a series of steps to create American jobs and to grow American wealth. We're ending the theft of American prosperity and rebuilding our beloved country.
Donald Trump wrapped himself in the cloak of America First with a backdrop of coal miners, and he bragged openly for all the world to see that he wants to destroy the environment in the name of corporate profits.
Rank in order, as you see it, the greatest challenges facing the United States: Russia, China, radical Islam.
I'll tell you, the one thing I know isn't is global warming. That's the one thing. No. That's the one thing I know isn't.
Trump has put a climate change denier in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt. He put a buffoon, Rick Perry, in charge of the Department of Energy. And Trump handed the U.S. State Department over to ExxonMobil's sort of former CEO, Rex Tillerson.
Words like climate consensus don't mean anything to us. They ring hollow because that's an oxymoronic statement. You cannot have a scientific consensus.
On Tuesday of this week, Trump issued yet another executive order, or as he calls it, executive action, smashing to pieces the Obama-era initiative that was known as the Clean Power Plan.
We have a very, very impressive group here to celebrate the start of a new era in American energy and production and job creation.
And when Obama announced that in 2014, he said that climate change was a national security issue. And the point of that plan was to try to move the U.S. away from energy sources that would damage the environment. Now, radical activists, environmental activists, criticize that plan as not going far enough, but it was something. And we had a president that actually acknowledged that climate change was real. Now, at the same time, Trump has begun issuing construction permits for the Keystone Pipeline. That had been delayed, and Obama had intervened at the end, and you had the uprisings at Standing Rock. Now Trump, gloating that he's going to make the pipeline great again, starts issuing these construction permits. Now, there's no doubt that this pipeline has the potential, the great potential, to cause serious harm to the homelands of indigenous people across swaths of the United States where this pipeline is going to run. And it's also going to put at risk the environment, the drinking water of ranchers and farmers and others in the path of this snaking pipeline. This is nothing short of a declaration of war on the planet that is coming directly from the Oval Office, directly from the most powerful position in the world. And they know damn well that climate change is real. They know it's not a hoax. So why do they lie? Money. Money and profits. It's as simple as that. It is a necessary lie for their corporate profits. They are treating the planet like it's a stock that they can short and then make a killing on. And they know that one day it's all going to come violently crashing to pieces. But the short-term profits, they're worth more to these bandits than the livelihood of the planet. I'm joined now by my colleague Naomi Klein. She has investigated and reported on climate change and its effects around the world. And she's also exposed some of the greatest corporate and human vultures who have contributed to this war against the planet and the war against our health. Naomi's latest book is This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. Naomi is now a senior correspondent for The Intercept. Naomi, welcome back to Intercepted.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to be with you.
Okay, we've got a lot to cover on the environment, on deregulation, on the insanity that seems to be taking place 24/7 at the White House. But I want to begin with the Keystone XL pipeline.
Today, I'm pleased to announce the official approval of the presidential permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. It's going to be an incredible pipeline, greatest technology known to man or woman.
Trump is issuing construction permits and moving forward with this incredibly controversial pipeline that has sparked massive indigenous-led protests in this country. Give us an overview of what the stakes are here and what's happening.
So, I mean, this isn't a surprise. It was one of his campaign pledges. He actually pushed it ahead his first day on the job. Now it's moving further along. They were waiting for State Department approval, which they now have, and they have without any kind of environmental assessment. They said they considered all of the factors and then listed them, and not one of those factors was climate change, which is really significant because when Obama finally said no to Keystone after years of protests, he said that one of the factors was that it would contribute to climate change. And that's because of what is in the pipe. The pipe starts in the Alberta tar sands and it ends at Gulf Coast refineries. That southern leg is already constructed, but it's the northern leg coming from Canada, going through South Dakota, Nebraska. That's what has yet to be constructed. Now, the reason why this is relevant in terms of climate change is twofold. One, because the oil in Alberta is a particularly heavy, carbon-intensive kind of oil. It has the consistency of tar. So what you have to do is mine it. And so there are many accidents associated with it. It's a particularly dangerous form of fuel on a bunch of different levels, but also this process of mining takes more energy than a conventional barrel of oil. On average, it takes 3 times more fossil fuels to extract 1 barrel of tar sands oil than a conventional barrel of North American crude. So from a climate perspective, it's a disaster. This has been such a defining feature of the Trump administration, this determination to unleash a fossil fuel frenzy. It is a major, major, major priority of Donald Trump. And it is not the only way to create jobs. You can create many more jobs, exponentially more jobs, if you invest in renewables, if you invest in energy efficiency, if you invest in public transit, than if you build a pipeline, right? I mean, Keystone is going to create 35 permanent jobs at the end of the day. But it is a very lazy way to create jobs, right? And it should not be lost on people that the company that will gain the most if these pipelines, these various pipelines, are constructed is ExxonMobil, the company that Rex Tillerson, now Secretary of State, was head of until a couple of months ago.
Oil sands projects like Kearl and the Keystone Pipeline will provide secure and reliable energy to the United States. Over the coming years, projects like these could create more than 500,000 jobs in the U.S. alone. From the Canadian border...
Exxon has around one-third of its fossil fuel reserves tied up in the Alberta tar sands. Now, if they can't get those reserves out, if they can't dig it up because they don't have the pipeline capacity, which is the current situation, then those become stranded assets. And of course, they also become stranded assets if there's serious climate regulation. And of course, the Trump administration is waging war on climate action on every front, most notably this week's attack on Obama's Clean Power Plan, which is the centerpiece of the Obama administration's plan to reduce emissions.
What are the long-term...
Naomi Klein in conversation with Jeremy Scahill on this new podcast called The Intercepted. I'm going to cut that. I'm going to thank again Ken out in Saybrook. Always like to make a call out to people listening in the hinterlands, because that's how I got started in community radio, listening to a broadcast out of St. Louis, Gaslight Square District, from a small town in southern Illinois. So if you're out there and you're listening, we hope you are, tell some people in your hood, in your neighborhood, in your region to check it out. There's a large variety offered here at WEFT, and we'd like to keep it that way. I've been going to The Intercepted because I just love Jeremy Scahill. His book on Blackwater was brilliant. I still have a couple of chapters to finish. Dirty War, which was made into a film documentary, which was nominated for Academy Award. Dirty Wars. And I think he's got another one subsequently. I forget now. But he's working mainly on this Intercepted and the Intercept Project, which is really doing a lot of great journalism and some great work and need to be featured. He always calls for people to review the podcast and like it and thank you and comment on it. Review it even on iTunes or wherever you might listen to it to try to spread it. And I feel like we need to propagate these alternative views. And that's why I come in and sludge here. Do the, what was that expression from that part of the Gulf War? I can't remember now. But I did promise some Marjorie Cohn, that's spelled C-O-H-N. You can find her on Facebook. She's a brilliant woman, very, very brave woman. And here she's interviewed on the program Flashpoints, which we went to earlier from KPFA Berkeley, first Pacifica station, in actually the first listener-supported model station. And some of the first FM broadcasts, too. They were actually giving out FM radios at the beginning of their inception so many years ago. But there's some other great stuff on Intercepted, this issue. But this is an important issue, and it also will be a part of our discussion tomorrow at 5 o'clock when I invite Danny Otto to talk about his trip to the West Bank and a conference he attended. He also ran into Mordecai Vanunu and had tea with him, the nuclear whistleblower who's got a court case to try to leave the country. He's technically not supposed to talk to foreigners, but he keeps running into people like Ellsberg and Ray McGovern. So without further ado, we'll hear a segment of this Marjorie Cohn talking to Dennis Bernstein.
Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, we turn our attention back to Israel and occupied Palestine. We're joined by Professor Marjorie Cohn. Professor Cohn is Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, editor and contributor to Drones and Targeted Killings, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. And Professor Cohn, it's good to have you back on Flashpoints.
Good to be back, Dennis.
Well, your piece is very disturbing. And maybe you should talk a little bit, remind people what the BDS movement is, and then put it in the context of the attack on Omar Barghouti.
Yes,
BDS is Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And the BDS movement was launched in 2005 by representatives of Palestinian civil society who called upon international civil society organizations and people of conscience all over the world to impose broad boycotts and implement divestment initiatives against Israel similar to those applied in South Africa in the apartheid era, including embargoes and sanctions against Israel. And the call for BDS specified three nonviolent punitive measures that would last until Israel fully complies with international law. By one, ending the occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the barrier wall. Two, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian citizens to full equality, and three, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their land as stipulated in UN General Assembly Resolution 194. And this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has been very successful. BDS was a major factor behind the 46% drop in foreign direct investment in Israel in 2014, according to a UN report. Israeli exporters have repeatedly complained that it's getting harder to export products to Europe. And a World Bank report showed that Israel's exports to the Palestinian economy dropped by 24% in the first quarter of 2015. I have specified a long list of all of the BDS successes in my piece that's posted on Consortium News today, Israel Hits Back Against Boycott. And those are government pension funds, investors like George Soros and Bill Gates, TIAA, CREF, and academic associations in the U.S., Canada, Ireland, South Africa, the U.K. Many churches, U.S. churches, have voted to divest from Israel. SodaStream closed its factory in the illegal Israeli settlement. French Telecom Orange left. That's a big, huge telecommunications company that takes care of phones and cable and everything else in France. They left the Israeli market because of Israel's role that they played in supporting the Israeli military's attacks on Gaza and involvement in the illegal Israeli settlements. There's the G4S company that provides security services and equipment to Israeli checkpoints, illegal settlements, and prisoners where there are Palestinian political prisoners. And they are selling their Israeli subsidiary after the BDS campaign cost the company millions of dollars in lost contracts, and Bill Gates' foundation cut its ties with that company. Now, locally, community mobilizations during Israel's 2014 attack on Gaza prevented Israeli ships from docking at a port in Oakland after actions by dock workers at ports in South Africa, Sweden, and India. So there have been lots of successes of this BDS movement, so much so that the Israeli government identifies BDS, the BDS movement, which is a nonviolent movement, as I said, to pressure Israel to end the occupation. And it is, they had that right up there with Iran as being an existential threat to Israel. And in fact, in his address to APEC earlier this week, Netanyahu said, "We will defend ourselves against slander and boycotts." And Israel is also stunned by the recent UN report co-authored by former Special Rapporteur for Occupied Palestinian Territories, Richard Falk, an international law expert, UN report, which said that Israel has initiated an apartheid regime, not just an occupation, but apartheid regime, and the Israeli government's very upset about that. So what, and they have made noises for a long time about going after leaders of BDS. There was a Stop the Boycott conference in Jerusalem last year, and in the Israeli public Public Security and Strategic Affairs Minister warned that BDS activists will know they will pay a price for it. Israel's intelligence minister at that conference called for attacks on BDS leaders, and he used the same Hebrew word that the military uses for targeted civil elimination or civil assassination. And in fact, Amnesty International was so concerned about threats against Omar Barghouti, who is a prominent Palestinian human rights defender and co-founder of the BDS movement, that they issued a statement that they were concerned about his safety of him and other BDS activists following calls alluding to threats, including of physical harm and deprivation of basic rights.
All right. Marjorie Cohn, we got that whole paragraph in. Thanks for listening. That's pretty incisive stuff, in my opinion. You can find her latest article on Consortium News. She writes for Truth Out. You can find her on Facebook, and it's spelled C-O-H-N. Anybody to thank? We had no callers in that last segment, but is there anybody to thank from the earlier?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. Well, thank you, whoever you are. We've got a full house here, Gina. Oh,
all right. So up next is CU Progressive News. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org and taking your calls this morning at 359. 359-